This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Vicarious Nails edition. It's Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. On today's show, It Comes at Night is the latest in a series of smaller budget, deeper think horror films. This one tells the story of a homestead in a plague-ridden near future. And then Claw stars Niecy Nash as the proprietress of a nail salon which launders money for the Florida mob. It's new on TNT. And finally, Beth Ditto is breaking out as a solo artist. We discuss her terrific new record, Fake Sugar. Joining me today is June Thomas, the managing producer of Slate podcast roster. June, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Christina Cotarucci, staff writer at Slate. Hey, Christina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you. All right, should we dig in? It Comes at Night is the new horror movie from young director Trey Edward Schultz. It takes place in a post-collapse America. There's very little exposition here, but much is disclosed between deep and moody silences. A plague apparently has reduced civilization to a set of off-grid homesteads. The movie takes place within one of those, a claustrophobic confines of a mixed-race couple and their teenage son. Everything changes when a second family joins them. What follows is an exquisitely wrought study in kinship, trust, and paranoia. Let's listen to a clip.
Before we listen to it, let's just set up what's happening. So in the course of the film, the key family comes into contact with another family. They eventually bring them into their home. And this is Paul, the father figure, going over the house rules. And I think you get a sense of the intense awkwardness that the director evokes.
The way we like to run things, and we think it's important, you know, we think it's important to keep a routine and stay busy.
Oh God, I'm sure I'm forgetting a few things.
There's plenty of time to work out all the details.
Yeah. Overload. Well, just settle in.
Yeah.
And we'll get working in the morning. And welcome.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, buddy. He's hiding.
Why are you hiding?
June, let me start with you. Are you, first of all, I'm very curious to know, are you a fan of the horror genre? Are you someone who goes and watches these and laps them up, or do you sit there with your sort of eyes between your fingers, or a little bit of both?
I am a person who has avoided anything horror or scary or even thrillery my entire life. So I was very, very nervous about going to see this film, and I went at like 2 p.m. so that I knew it would be bright light outside when I went in and when I left and all of that. I actually didn't find it that scary, though. Did you?
Oh, I found it very scary. I mean, it's more dreadful than it is scary, but...
To me, the scariest thing... So it wasn't a hugely well-attended screening that I went to, but every time somebody got up and there was kind of, creaky seats or doors opening and closing, that was scary to me. It was the act of being in the cinema when an air of sort of portentousness or something terrible could happen at any second had been established. But the film itself didn't make my heart race all that much. So I'm kind of curious what it was about it that got your hearts racing.
Well, wait a second. Before you throw it back on me, did you like the movie?
I mean, I liked it. I thought it was very well done. I thought the acting was superb. I thought that the director was extremely effective at establishing a tone and of really conjuring a world. But it didn't really do much for me at the same time. Like, I just had this feeling of, okay, now what? I think I've actually been broken by television. I mean, I think, like, the next episode would be great. Like, this is a show that's going to get better with every episode. But as I left the cinema, like, I really admired the director's restraint. But at the same time, I was just sort of, well, that was fine. It just didn't, like, it never got to the next level for me.
That's interesting. All right, Christine, bail me out here. I love this movie. Did you like it?
Yeah, I think from the very first frame, I was scared and kind of sinking down in my seat with my sweater over the bottom of my face and immediately regretted my decision to go to the screening alone. I thought it was pretty impressive that I was sort of sunk down in a pit of terror for almost the whole movie, considering that there's no monster. You know, the thing that they're scared of is not like a supernatural death creature or any sort of murderer on the loose. It's contagious disease. And yet there's, because the family is so paranoid, I think the film does a really good job of making that paranoia contagious. I was very happy that I left the theater when it was light out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is a movie almost completely without a gimmick, right? I mean, the closest it comes to having a gimmick is that there is no it. And the movie doesn't draw you along with the false promise that there's going to be one. In my estimation, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. To my mind, it's kind of a small masterpiece. I mean, what the amount, the movie that I kept comparing it to in my head in a way was Get Out, which I also think is in its own way a masterpiece too. And Get Out is kind of a horror movie, but not really a horror movie. It's really a study of social mores and racial mores. It delivers a lot of information expositionally, and it's very plotted, very thought out, and very tight. But a lot of its information is conveyed through dialogue. Whereas in this one, so much information is delivered, if not virtually all of it, by the camera. And in a young director, to trust that he doesn't need jokes, that he doesn't need backstory, that he doesn't need speeches, that he doesn't need very much at all, that the camera can deliver the movie, I thought was remarkable. I think this guy, I haven't seen his first movie, and now I'm going to eagerly seek it out, because he understands the storytelling powers of the camera brilliantly. And secondarily, it's about whether or not the family as a unit is going to survive, and what sacrifices within a family unit are acceptable in order to keep it as an organic entity larger than the sum of its parts going. And those kind of that dread and those moral dilemmas to me were completely alive through the course of the entire film, and its final images. I mean, I wouldn't, the very final image is arresting, is going to stay with me for weeks, but there's a penultimate image that makes you realize this guy, the screenwriter director, was thinking through everything he was doing.
Yeah, I definitely felt that Trey Edward Schultz, the writer-director, knew what he was doing. He was very good at what he was doing. It just didn't grab me. It just didn't make, I admired it, but didn't really feel it. But I would say that I loved so we've been talking about like the Key family, played by Joel Edgerton, Carmen Ejogo and Kelvin Harrison Jr., who is extraordinary as their son, Travis. And then there's the big thing that develops is their relationship and how much they can trust this second family that they come to meet under weird circumstances when the second paterfamilias breaks into their home. And he's played by Christopher Abbott, who some of us will know from Girls, which is its own kind of association. And so, but eventually this second family, a younger family, comes and shares their space. And it was, and Schultz was incredibly effective at showing awkwardness. I mean, the clip that we heard was, a masterclass in awkwardness. But that feeling of, we need to cooperate. We know we need to cooperate. It's the right thing to do. It's the good thing to do. But is it going to lead to our death? And how you kind of, the notion of politeness and how we get along with each other, that was really very, very well achieved, again, with this incredible spareness that was the key to the movie in many ways.
The performances of the cast members, too, made it possible for there to be an entire horror movie within the confines of one house. And what was happening outside, or what the actual, scary thing was, could have been anything. It could have been a war raging outside, or, a frightening creature on the loose, or a disease as it was. But, the fact that they were all trapped inside this house for the vast majority of the film and still made it feel like there was, something banging at the door at all times waiting to get in, and made us feel trapped in there, or made me feel trapped in there with them. I don't want to speak for you, June.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like in addition to the, remarkable information conveying powers of the camera in the hands of someone who really knows how to use one, there's just the performances. I mean, Kelvin, a lot of the movie is focalized through the 17-year-old son, Travis. He's played by Kelvin Harrison Jr. That is an amazing performance, I think, on his part. He is very gifted because he's both precocious and self-possessed and facing up to the situation his family finds itself in. At the same time, he's its most sensitive barometer of the intensity of its dread, mixed in with this kind of totally forbidden sexual longing he starts to feel for the mother of the other family. June, I just got to disagree with you on this one. I think this movie is special. I think people should seek it out. I'm giving it three thumbs up to compensate for the one you're gonna withhold.
I mean, I really do think the fault is with me. I really have been broken by television. I don't really watch those zombie shows, but I have become conditioned not only to feel that dread, but then for the dread to be broken through and for some staggering creature to come through the door and, cause the gun to be used. It's a pathetic thing that has happened to me, but it has happened. And
so jaded.
I know I am. I did feel,
was that it for you? You were disappointed that there was no big frightening payoff?
No, there was nothing specific. There was no moment I'm like, well, that was a failure. I just didn't connect with it. It just, like, I left the cinema you know, very aware of what I had just seen. I was never really in it. I never felt I was in that house. And as I say, I'm somebody, you know, this could also be because I've always avoided scary movies, and maybe I just don't have the right vocabulary. Maybe it's a twisteroo, and because I'm not really completely familiar with the format, I'm, you know, not getting that. So I'm sure the fault is within me, but, There was so much that I admired, the spareness, the restraint, the acting. Another thing that I'll just mention, as an only child myself, we don't know for sure that Travis is an only child, but the way that he was portrayed, I got the impression of somebody who's been just with his parents, who suddenly has to deal with other people. And I thought that even if it was just that, even if there was no, you know, contagion without, I really enjoyed that performance, or that presentation of learning to deal with other people in your world. But it left me a little bit cold.
All right. Well, can I just say for the record that the point of this segment was not to make June Thomas feel small for her lack of appreciation for cinema. In the age of peak TV.
Peak
the
TV.
Cinema. Your debased tastes are welcome here. On a weekly basis. All right. Well, anyway, the movie is It Comes at Night. Check it out, or trust June Thomas and don't. It Comes at Night is out there. You can find it at a multiplex near you, and come to facebook.com/culturefest and tell us what you thought. All right, moving on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, before we proceed to talk about Claws, June, I'm assuming we have some business this week. What do we got?
We sure do. First, we want to tell you about one of Slate's other great shows, The Gist with Mike Pesca, Slate's daily podcast covering politics and culture. It's a really astonishing to see how this show comes together, because it is a daily production. Much of it comes from the crazy mind of Mike Pesca, and he is really responding to the news kind of minutes after it happens. And it's one of those shows where once you have seen how it comes together, and, you know, the work that the producers do, the sort of the craziness, the crazy genius of Mike Pesca, the one's appreciation of it is even higher. Recently, the shows had John Ronson, who was the screenwriter of the movie Okja, comedian Larry Wilmore, and Senator Al Franken. You may have heard of him. So check it out every weekday afternoon at slate.com/thegist, or wherever you get your podcasts. And in Slate Plus today, we'll be talking about snowflakes, specifically Amanda Hess's exegesis of this term, which is often used these days by conservatives, or really kind of right wingers, to describe the delicate feelings of we liberals. Slate Plus members get bonus segments like that one from all your favorite Slate shows, plus ad-free podcast. It also happens that now is the best and easiest time ever to try Slate Plus. You can get Slate Plus for free for 90 days by downloading our new iOS app at slate.com/app. And you can get all the benefits of Slate Plus for 3 months. It's a brand new app, and by far the easiest way to get those bonus segments and ad-free podcasts. So get Slate Plus by trying the app for free for 90 days at slate.com/app. All right, back to the show.
Claws is the latest entry in Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know TV. It stars Niecy Nash as the owner of a nail salon that doubles down as a laundromat for a drug money mob. And the show is lurid and outre. does that make it loutre? I don't know. Let's listen to a clip.
You thought you was gonna skip a couple steps, huh, bitch? Oh. Look at you. You nothing but a tossed out, pantless, junior, Okeechobee cocksucker of the month with your skankroid ass hanging out your clothes. I gave you a chance, bitch. Out the kindness of my heart. I taught you a trade, for fuck's sake, and this is how you thank me?
This is how you thank her? I can help y'all, Desmond.
I don't need your help.
I'm kind of shit.
Yeah, we don't need your help. I know you was the one who told Roller about Polly's ankle bracelet. Shame on you, coming after a 45-year-old woman.
I'm not 45.
You dumb bitch. You was never gonna be in my crew. Never, ever.
No, wow. Oh, my Lord. Well, one would not say that that scene is underwritten. Christina, I'm very curious. This is your first time as a full, you know, panelist on the show. You joined us for a plus once. But so I'm curious. I don't know what your TV habits are. So to frame the segment a little bit, do you watch a lot of TV? And then tell me what you thought of this.
I don't watch a lot of TV. I watch sort of an embarrassingly mainstream roster of TV shows. I love a good Shonda show. I watch House of Cards. You know, like the things that everyone talks about, I watch. But I don't really seek out new shows before they've been approved by a lot of other people I like. I loved Claws, and I had no idea what to expect going in other than it was about a nail salon. And I love to live vicariously through people with long nails. As a lesbian, I'm never going to have them. So honestly, I was hoping that it would have more nails. There weren't a lot of shots of people's like really amazingly well done and elaborate manicures. But other than that, I thought it was a lot of fun. It was so surprising. The characters have all of these delightful quirks that sort of get revealed over the course of several episodes. It was extraordinarily queer in, again, a lot of surprising ways. And it was stylized and fast moving and goofy and also dramatic. And yeah, I can't wait to watch more of it.
Christina, I am surprised to learn that you are a basic TV bitch. I thought you would be
it's
like
so embarrassing.
So have you seen Niecy Nash before?
No, I haven't. She was one of my favorite parts of this show. I think she's cast perfectly and, you know, carries the show beautifully.
Yeah, she is an amazing actress. She has done a lot of comedy. She was a key part of Reno 911, in which she was amazing. And then she, you know, she's done a bunch of shows, but more recently her career has kind of taken a turn. I believe she's 47. So, you know, the world has taken its time to recognize her genius.
Wow, 47. And not that that's old.
That's right. She's young, girl. She was in the HBO show Getting On, in which she played a nurse on a geriatric ward. And the part is very similar to her role in Claws. Claws is heightened and a little bit crazy and definitely over the top in a way that Getting On was absolutely not. But there's this feeling that this woman, who knows that she's being exploited a lot of the time, knows that the world is not fair, that she's not getting a fair shake. And she recognizes it, but she also recognizes the limits of what she can do, which doesn't mean she can't do anything. It doesn't mean that she has to just put up with shit. But there's a kind of recognition of the way the world works, which I love. And she's such an expressive actress. She can be so over the top, and she's great when she's over the top. But she also has mad acting skills, so that there is this element of you know that she's having feelings, and you know that she just understands the world, and she's just extraordinarily good at that. And I just love this show. It's like one of those hyper shows, you know. These days on television, there's a lot of crazy stuff, which seems to usually consist of ridiculous plot twists. And, you know, I mean, you watch Scandal, Christina, every week. It's something ridiculous is going to happen. And that's kind of the fun of it. This show, it's going to have some plot. I've only watched the two episodes that have aired, but I already know that there are going to be some crazy plot twists. But that's not where the craziness lies. The craziness is in how unfair life is and how weird life is. And, you know, just the color of the, you know, the nails. Christina, you mentioned, or rather the color of the salon. You mentioned that there wasn't enough nail action for you. I also a little bit craved more sort of nail art, but I also loved the way that we see them struggling all the time. No, they're actually not struggling. They're very comfortable, but to my short nailed view, they're kind of the way that they could even just use the telephone with these, you know, 3-inch talons, or, you know, move a dead body, or do just face the challenges, both normal and strange, was just kind of awesome. That was a nice nail feature for me. Steve, I am dying of curiosity to know what you thought of this work of genius.
Well, you know, the show that you two describe sounds like one that I would enjoy, but I hated this one.
Oh, my God.
But listen, it's I know I'm the room got cold all of a sudden. I mean, this is the show is not aimed at a normie like me, an old white cis hetero, sanctimonious dipshit like
get off of this show.
And so cancel
your account.
It reflects on me, not on the show. But here's what let me begin by with what I liked about the show. I was a huge fan, unrivaled fan of Reno 911. Niecy Nash finally getting a vehicle for her full talents is miraculous. That's terrific. I love her in the show. The best writing in the show is her dialogue. You heard, I thought, what was the best clip from the first episode there when she throws this minx who's fucking with her life every which way out on her ass. That's a terrifically written scene. She lives it perfectly. I bet half of those lines came out ad-libbed in the moment. And if they didn't, she's only a better actress for how she pulled it off. I love the sight of Hank Schrader brought back from the dead is, you know, wonderful. Dean Norris, maybe my favorite TV actor, or certainly delivered one of my favorite TV performances of all time. But there it kind of ended. I didn't think he was put to very good use. And what I didn't like about this show is that the competition to push boundaries it didn't make me think of a lurid, mobbed up nail salon in Florida. It made me think of middle aged TV executives throwing around the word edgy, and that's where it started to lose me. I just thought that the pilot episode was a somewhat spastic dance for people's attention, and it kept trying to push boundaries and push buttons without settling into itself in a way. I really dislike the character and the performance by the actor who plays Niecy Nash's boyfriend,
Roller.
This lug. Mm. I don't believe she's involved with that guy. The writers do not need to make him that stupid. But I will say this, the show that you describe is one that I'd be interested in watching. So if your description is accurate, let me put it a slightly different way, is that you have described what to me is most interesting about the show, which is the predicament that she is in and her attempt to find her own agency and deploy it within the circumstances, the vice of the circumstances as they surround her, like her relationship to the laundering operation, the feel good doctor who's peddling the pills, the Russian mob who's trying to, you know, make a headway into their business, the Hank Schrader mob with whom she has to have a relationship through the son. I mean, all of that to me is interesting because Niecy Nash is interesting and there's nothing she could do on screen that wouldn't make me want to watch her. I just thought the writing was kind of all over the place and it was just throwing shit at the wall. I thought, but maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe that's just the fate of every pilot episode is to try to get the world and the apparatus up and running takes an enormous amount of slightly unfocused energy. And maybe it settles in over the course of several episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do think that all pilots have just an almost impossible job to throw, you know, 16 balls in the air and keep them all juggling and try and find something for everyone. So it's an almost impossible task that, you know, more than 400 shows do every year. But, and I have to say that some of the things you described, some of the things you mentioned, like were like, yeah, I didn't like that. You know, as you were sort of going through them, you know, I find pretty much everything with Dean Norris, who plays, as you say, the daddy, the big daddy character of this,
Uncle,
you know,
Daddy.
Uncle Daddy. He is kind of the kingpin, but the not terribly convincing kingpin of this Dixie Mafia that's running the pill mill. And for me, like, I was able, as you were going through there, I realized that what I was able to do as I was watching was kind of focus on the stuff that I liked and just kind of, not exactly ignore, but just kind of put it to one side and think, well, that is what Desna, which is Niecy Nash's character, that's what Desna has to deal with to achieve her dreams. She has a dream of getting a new place. She lives with her brother, Dean, who's autistic, who's played by Harold Perrineau. That character right now is not very convincing. The Uncle Daddy character is too over the top. Roller, Yeah, he was kind of a handful. He reminded me, I'm sure, intentionally of Spring Breaker, the movie that I absolutely loved, actually. You know, and I guess that's a particular type of character that, you know, when you have to establish very quickly, you go to 10 with it. But, you know, something that you also said, Steve, that, you know, it's TV executives looking for edgy. That was the opposite of what I thought. I felt that this is probably a show that got greenlit because of its kind of demographics. You know, TNT is a network that traditionally appeals to women. It's traditionally, its big hits have been kind of, you know, women-centered police dramas. They're changing a little bit. But this is a kind of a different kind of woman-centered show about a different kind of woman. These aren't cops. They're kind of criminals, but they're reluctant criminals. They're women who know that they maybe have to break the law because the world isn't fair. And I just loved the women. I don't care about the men at all, but I loved all of the women, and I loved and totally believed that Desna would be kind of the mama bear looking after these women that she saw as her crew.
June, I know you've written about or talked about the phenomenon of competency porn in TV. And I thought this was a really great corrective for that. These are pretty incompetent middle management criminals.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough of that. I think that's a very underrepresented demographic in TV. I loved watching them screw up and do surprising things. Steve, I encourage you to watch future episodes because I think that you will be surprised where it goes. I also liked it just as a series of postcards or pages, almost like a graphic novel. I think there are a lot of really beautiful details in the show, like there's a totally over the top funeral where, you know, there's a tower of those, what are they, ho-hos, or those little
Debbie snack cakes, I believe.
There's some little Debbie snack cakes at this funeral, and exotic dancers play a large role in a way that you don't normally see them portrayed. And I recently watched The Sopranos. Speaking of my mainstream TV watching, I watch everything a decade after it was popular. And thinking about the way that strip club mob money laundromat is portrayed in that show versus this show was really fun and refreshing.
Yeah, Shishi's, which is the strip club that where some of the action of Claws takes part, is really the Bada Bing from the woman's point of view. And I did love the just this whole world of women who are entrepreneurs. You know, they're either cam girls or they're strippers or they work in nail salons or they own nail salons or they run nail salons. And these are not respectable jobs, or they're not jobs that if you were, you know, at what is it, the junior league, they would not get you in. They might not get you a better piece of real estate. But that doesn't mean that these women are trash by any means. And I loved that we got to see women who are so often just written off as, you know, the girl who's going to be twirling in the background, that this time they're in the foreground. And it's not just, let's just put one of those women in the foreground. It works for me as a really, like, I believe this is their world, and it's not just some TV exec trying to be edgy. It's something that got by a TV exec from my point of view.
So the show is Claws. Apparently it's a fucking masterpiece. check it out. It's on TNT. Come to Facebook.com/CultureFest and tell me why I'm completely wrong. All right, moving on. Beth Dudo is already known to music fans as the lead singer of the wonderful group Gossip. Now she's got a solo record, her first, on which she rediscovers her Southern roots. She mixes them in with the punk rock that had inspired the origins of Gossip, all while redefining what a pop diva should look like and stand for. Let's listen to a cut from Fake Sugar. All right, well, June, there's going to be absolutely no problems getting to consensus on this topic. This is just an amazing record from an amazing singer and artist. Tell us about Beth Ditto.
Well, I must admit that I mostly know Beth Ditto as an icon rather than an actual performer. Like, I, you know a few of her songs, but like, I bought her memoir. I would have bought this album, whether or not we were talking about it. Not because, and I'm not even sure if I would have listened to it much, but it was almost in that way of like, this is someone who I really want to succeed. And so I almost want to become a patron of the arts, and I will buy her output to support her, which is a weird, I'm very aware is kind of a weird impulse because, like I say, I don't really know her music that well. I just know that she's this, you know, big feminist lesbian or queer woman who's out there and who's so unapologetic and who makes out with her girlfriend or boyfriend on the red carpet and who is just always as big and unapologetic and as confident as I want everyone to be. And so I almost like, I love her for who she is almost more than for what she does.
Christina, it's an interesting way to come at her, right? Not through the music at all, but through this, you know, kind of, you know, surrounding iconography of Beth Ditto. Which angle did you come at her from most? More the music or this public image?
I come at it from both angles. I truly do love her music and the music she's made with her band Gossip, which recently broke up. But I also love her as a pop icon, as a style maven. She's, you know, shaved off her eyebrows. She's been mused to many fashion designers. She's released her own line of clothing. She probably would love some of the nail art we saw on Claws. She's, like June said, outspoken, but also sort of unarguably cool. And, you know, fat, and her clothing line is for plus size women. Yeah, I love everything she does. And I had more of a mixed take on this album. I love the songs that remind me of the best of the Gossip, mm-hmm. which is to say, upbeat and fun, dance punk, sort of disco inflected songs. I think where she tried to sort of make her own thing happen now that she's out of the Gossip, and some of the slower, more southern or classic rock tinged songs didn't click with me as well.
Well, it's funny. I know nothing about her public image, which is shame on me, but I, you know, that's the bubble that I live in. But I love the record. I mean, I have to say she's, you know, she just has that. She just has it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she just has the ability to put all of her life experience, you know, into a vocal performance, you know, just incredible expressive range and you know, musical facility. But it's funny that that some of the music is really uncharacteristic of her earlier work. Christina, maybe just talk a little bit about the evolution of Gossip. I mean, they started more on the kind of Courtney Love end of the spectrum and worked their way towards Southern inflected soul, as I understand it.
Yeah. And, you know, Beth Ditto, as far as I know, sort of came of age in the Riot Girl scene. And you can definitely hear some of that in this album. And definitely in her onstage performance, which is totally over the top. And like you said, I mean, she can command a room like nobody's business. But at the same time, her voice is clear. I almost get sort of a musical theater vibe from her. Like, she's got a beautiful vibrato, which you don't hear all that often in punk. So in a way, I think that this album is sort of the logical conclusion of where she was meant to go. And I think I just need a little time to get used to it. But also, I did love seeing, like, I got a little bit of Dolly Parton vibes from a couple of these songs. And, you know, also from just her persona as this big, unapologetic femme. And yeah, I highly recommend it to anyone. I'm not trying to downplay how great the album is. But yeah, it was interesting and sort of shocking for me to hear some of the slower songs. And one of them sounded like, I think she called it her U2 song.
Yes.
And made me think of Bruce Springsteen. It was completely out of the blue.
Yeah, so that's a song called We Could Run. And the album is really, I would say, inconsistent. Sounds like just a criticism, which I guess it kind of is, although I don't know that albums have to be consistent. There are all kinds of styles, you know, from one song to the next. One minute we're in this kind of, you know, you can imagine it in a gay country western bar. The next song, you know, is more slow and moody. The next song is, well, this one, We Could Run. She described it as a U2 song. And so maybe I heard that before I heard the song. I don't know if I would have, you know, given it that label myself, but it is totally true. And in a way, it highlights her voice in a way that some of the other songs don't. I mean, you really see that she could belt, for example, just to give another musical theater term.
All right, well, we all agree this is a terrific record. But June, I have a question. Let me see if I can formulate it. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to understand is why Beth Ditto and why now? I'm starting to hear her name everywhere, right? Like, I can't swing a cat without smacking Beth Ditto in the forehead. You know, NPR, everyone loves us. What is it, something about the music that explains the universal love, the persona, the moment, or are they just all coming together cosmically right now?
I think that it is more the persona. I think it's, you know, the fact that Vogue, you know, did a big piece about her. There was even a video where Beth Ditto goes to Brighton Beach. There's something that's so attractive about a person who shouldn't be confident by the way that our society works, who grew up poor in the South. She's from Arkansas. She's fat. She is stylish. She is the kind of person that people make fun of. She doesn't give a shit. She is confident. She is proud. She's out there. And I just feel that we're all craving that right now. You know, we see this. I don't want to, you know, go full Trump, but, you know, we see how confidence, blind confidence, can lead to deception and self-delusion and maybe even an entire national delusion for some parts of, for maybe a narrow non-majority of the population. But I just feel that at the time where we're aware of bullying in Pride Month, I can kind of pull together this whole grab bag of like, not quite the whole reason. I mean, I did enjoy the album. But it's not because of the music that I like her. I just love her. And there's something about her as the face of America, or as one voice of America, that I just love. And I just want her to succeed so that more people like her will succeed, I guess.
I think for some people, myself included, even if they're not familiar with her whole body of work, there might be a song or two that people connect to and, you know, they lend themselves well to being personal pump-up anthems. And I think for me, one reason why this album has gotten a lot of traction among my friends is just it's Pride Month. It's the beginning of summer. And for me, that's what Beth Ditto does best is, you know, something that could, for instance, go on the Culture Gabfest's Summer Strut playlist. Songs that make you feel great about yourself, that make you dance. She recently was talking about Standing in the Way of Control, which I think is one of GOTSIP's biggest hits and one of my personal pump-up anthems. And she said, you know, I don't know. It's surprising to me that this is still relevant right now. She compared it to the sign people sometimes hold at protests these days saying, you know, why do I still have to I can't believe I'm still protesting this shit. And I think there, you know, though this album is sort of an evolution of her personal sound, there is a timelessness to the ferocity and excitement and sensuality and, you know, a lotness or too muchness of their music.
That's a fantastic answer. So why don't you pick, Christina or June, pick a cut for us to go out on that is Summer Struddy.
Oh my God. That song, the chorus of it.
All right, well, the album is Fake Sugar from Beth Ditto. We loved it. Tell us what you thought. Facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse June Thomas. What do you have?
Well, mostly I want to take this opportunity to, you know, boast that I got to see Julius Caesar at Shakespeare in the Park. And so since probably most people can't see it because it's ending very soon, even if we all were in New York City, I just really want to rave about the genius of Elizabeth Marvell. She is mostly a New York theater actress, although she often shows up on TV shows that are filmed in New York. And she is a brilliant actress. And in Julius Caesar, she played Mark Antony. And she was running around. She was screaming. She was crying. She was doing all of those things that great theater actors do. And she was doing it like 2 inches from the seats, you know, because they did kind of go into the bleachers kind of thing. And she is just an actress who, whenever she shows up, whatever role she's gotten, she just elevates everything. And so this is my plug for the complete works of Elizabeth Marvell. Also, she has amazing hair, and you always notice her hair. I'm really not like a person who likes long hair, generally speaking, but she just has amazing hair. So, Elizabeth Marvell and her amazing hair.
Fantastic. Christina, what do you have?
So I'm not sure if the world is in a golden age of short stories right now, or if I'm just in a golden age of reading a lot of great short stories. But I recently came across a 2015 collection of short stories, Rebecca Mackay's Music for Wartime. I think I found this on a friend's bookshelf and liked the sound of it. And it was one of those books that, you know, I lost a lot of sleep over, because I found this book's treatment of cross-generational trauma really compelling. She goes from stories about the AIDS crisis, family histories of massacres in World War II and religious terror. And then she brings it back to the present with an examination of how reality TV producers can fuck with people's lives, which is, you know, considering the present scandal with Bachelor in Paradise and accusations of sexual assault, I found, surprisingly current. I'm always impressed with an author who can deliver a whole book's worth of emotion in a couple pages of a short story. And this is a book that did that for me.
Ah, fantastic. All right. Well, I'm going to slip in an extra endorsement here, which is for Reno 911, the show that featured Niecy Nash, a comedy show, sort of golden era Comedy Central TV show about a bumbling police department in Reno, incredible ensemble cast doing increasingly goofy, nonsensical things week after week. It's really worth doing a mini binge on it if you get a chance, and she's terrific in it. But my endorsement this week is the film critic David Thompson has written an entry in the Jewish Lives series of books from Yale University Press. And he had a slightly unexpected assignment, which is to write about Jack Warner of the Warner Brothers. And what he did instead really is he wrote a book called Warner Brothers. He wrote it about all of the four brothers. The Making of an American Movie Studio is the subtitle. But what the book really is about, in a way, it's in its own way a kind of skewed history of the 20th century as told through the movie studio that, you know, started out as a fly-by-night operation, as many of them did out in the movie colony in California, got kind of lucky with sound on film. They broke it first with the jazz singer and then immediately built on that advantage quite shrewdly and quite aggressively. And they went into gangster pictures with Edward G. Robinson and Cagney. They discovered Humphrey Bogart and put him obviously to perfect use finally after not understanding his talents in The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca, but on and on and on and on up through Bonnie and Clyde in the late 60s. But there's something about that trajectory. And Thompson, what I like about it is a very essayistic book. It doesn't presume to be a work of original research. It's not. His principal ability is as a critic and not as a historian. So he reads much of that history through the films that they made. But for example, the careers of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, the studio's very troubled, but in many ways, interestingly equivocal, or a relationship to women and strong women in particular. It just on and on and on and on. Its relationship to World War II, to Ronald Reagan. It is not the least appropriate lens through which to look at the American Empire, because such a central part of our status as the country, the society that defined the 20th century was Hollywood film. And Warner was at the center. Warner's was at the center of that. And he gets at that without hammering it. You know, that's really the point, is that he really reads these films as highly specific, idiosyncratic documents. But the cumulative effect of the book is rather surprising, which is that at the end of it, you get a sense of what American society was to the 20th century. Highly recommend it. Christina, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a total pleasure, and I hope we have you back soon as a guest or a co-host.
This was a blast. Thank you.
Excellent. June, always a total pleasure. It's been way too long. I don't even remember the last time I podcasted with you.
Anytime.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Or, as always, drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. The managing producer is June Thomas. And, of course, Andy Bowers. He's the poopah, right? Chief Content Officer of the Panoply Network. Culture Gap Fest is part of that network. You can check out an entire roster of great shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Christina Cotterucci and June Thomas, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.